So what we're going to do today is actually has been inspired by something I said last week, and then I repeated it by the Shabbat table. Yes, I also speak at the Shabbat table. I'm not the only, I guess you guys are not the only ones that do. And I said something, and my son Yishai immediately responded, and also my grandson Kedem, they were with us for Shabbos, just the grandchildren, and his ears picked up, and it was interesting because he actually showed me something about what I'd said later. So for a 5-year-old, he was not bad at all, and I'm not telling you what it is yet. We're gonna get there still. So what we're gonna try to do today is we're gonna do a bit of pshat. We're gonna get into a little bit of midrash. We're going to see also some rabbinic, especially Kabbalists, imaginations and where it took them. And along the way, hopefully, we'll have some more insight as well. I mean, there's certain things about this parsha that I've said before that I'd love to say it again, but I can't just say the same thing every time. Because at least some of you who perhaps would remember would be upset, but moreover, I would be. So it's so let's start. Let's start at the beginning. So we find ourselves in Parshat Vayishlach, where Yaakov is on the cusp of returning to the land of Israel, and that's not a very simple thing, because as we know, Yaakov left a long time ago, and when he left under, shall we say, complex circumstances. The one bracha about him leaving was that both his mother and his father had told him to do it. They finally spoke with one voice, even though we know that they had different motivations for it. And let's just start with the first source, number one, Pasuk Chet, Lamed Bet Chet, Vayira Yaakov Ma'od, Vayetzer Lo. Yaakov was really afraid. Now, right there, we have to ask ourselves, why is he afraid? And I think we all know why. Because there is this bloodthirsty brother of his, Esav, and maybe you'll think it's not fair for me to call him bloodthirsty. Well, as we're going to learn very, very quickly, we have every reason to be concerned. And let's just, again, get a little perspective. Yaakov has sent messengers to Esav. And Esav has been on the way. So now, how exactly does Esav know to be on the way? I don't have an answer to that. Which means somehow Esav has some intel. He knows, or he's heard, he's found out that Yaakov is coming back. For all we know, he hired spies and let us know when Yaakov starts to move and he's going to stop him. But let's just like keep perspective. He comes to greet him. I use the word greet. I use that very loosely. He comes to greet him with 400 men. So we don't know right now, that a lot, is that a little? So again, just for some perspective, we know that we know that Avram went out to war once, and we went out to war, it was in the middle of a major battle, we can even call it a world war. And let's keep in mind, populations then were not what populations are now. So there, that was the war of the four kings against the five kings, and Avraham, together with 318 soldiers, was able to be victorious in a war of four kings against five kings. And now Esav is coming at Yaakov with 400 people. So I'm just saying, that's more soldiers than were utilized for Avram to win World War I, or pre-World War I. And now Esav is coming with more than that amount of people to greet his brother. Now, just in case any of you had in your mind, well, it was most likely a marching band. I mean, Lavan said, had he known that he was leaving, he would have sent a marching band. So presumably, when Esav finds out he's coming back, he's going to come with a marching band. I hope I didn't convince any of you with that, because that's not what we suspect, and it's not what Yaakov fears. Yaakov fears bloodshed, and he said, and right away he goes, I think the best thing is to call it tactics, because again, he's frightened. Chazal tell us, famously, Chazal tell us that Yaakov takes three different modes of behavior. One is prayer, and one is bribery, and the third one is a military tactic. Now, but this military tactic is not training his people with weapons. His military tactic is, let me divide into two camps. I mean, as it says right here, it says Vayachatz et ha'am asher ito v'tatzon v'tabakar v'gmalim l'shnei machanot. He divides them, and he says what his strategy is. Vayomer im yavo Esav That's his military battle. Let's run away. His military battle is we're going to run in two different directions and maybe somebody's going to be safe. That's not, you know, exactly what I would call military strategy. So since Yaakov prepares himself for three things, it's a little overstated to say that he prepared himself for war in the sense of being an active participant trying to be victorious. This is someone trying to run away and to keep alive what he possibly can. So again, this is not looking very good. And then Yaakov prays. That is one of the strategies. V'yom Yaakov, Elokei Avi Avraham, Elokei Avi Yitzchak, Hashem ha'omer elai shuv la'aretzecha u'lemalitcha v'etiva imach. You know, you're the one who told me to come back and everything's going to be good. So now I don't know what to say right now. Is this a lack of faith on Yaakov's part? And I'm sorry for asking that, but I'm just saying. He's saying, you told me to come back, okay? You told me to come back, so everything's going to be good. And you said you're going to take care of me. So why doesn't Yaakov believe that? So the reason he doesn't believe it is because of reality. And reality facing him is very dire. So I'm really not judging Yaakov at this point, but I am at least raising that question. Is there a problem in this prayer? Is there a problem in his fear? And katonti mikol ha-chasadim and kol ha-met asher asita et avdecha ki b'makli avarti et erdein hazeh v'tayiti l'shnei machanot. I crossed over with only my walking staff in hand, and now I've become two camps. Now, being two camps is not a good thing. I mean, it better be one large camp than to be two camps. And then he prays, Hatzileni na miyad achim yad esav, save me. Ki yorei anochi. Right? I am afraid. Oto pen yavo vakeni ema banim. I'm afraid he's going to kill everybody here. So therefore, it's, again, whether Esav is intending that or not is a whole separate question. The fact that he comes with 400 soldiers is certainly enough to put fear in Yaakov. Yaakov articulates his fear to God. And by the way, according to everyone, this would be the type of prayer which would be a fulfillment of a Torah-level prayer. You're in distress, you turn to God, you say to God, I need help, please help me. That's what Yaakov fears. Again, I raise the question, should he feel the fear? Well, that's another point. I mean, how much could any of us ever control our emotions? But nonetheless, he said something which to me is problematic. He says, God, you told me to come back and look what's happened. Vata amarta hitiv hitiv imach, and you said it's going to be good. V'samti etzarech l'chol yom asher lo yisaper mirov, and he's afraid that they're about to be decimated, and you said that, you know, we're going to be so numerous. And Yaakov, you know, in a certain sense, what Yaakov is experiencing right now, I don't know if you sense it, he's experiencing what Avraham does not articulate by the Akedah. You told me to do something, and you told me that I'm going to have many, many descendants. And what you're about to tell me to do is going to contradict the ability for me to have descendants. So I don't know if you realize that. This, in a sense, is Yaakov's Akedah. And he says the words that Avram never says, which, of course, some of us are upset with Avram for not praying and not saying it. And some of us now are upset for Yaakov for saying it. So basically, you know, we're Jews. We can't live it no matter what. But I don't know if you ever sense that comparison over here. But what Yaakov is saying is really what Avram should have said. And I don't know if, once he says it, I don't know how much we like it. And he sends off this gift. That's part of the plan is to bribe as well. We can skip all of the details about what it is that he sends. And he tells the first group and the second group and so on. And so on and so on and so forth. Pasuk Kaf Bet, Vatavar Mincha al Panav, Hulan Belaila Hu B'machane. And Yaakov stays in the Machane. Vayokom Belaila Hu, but he gets up at night. So I don't know how to deal with the end of Kaf Bet, the beginning of Kaf Gimel. Also, Yaakov has a problem. If it's Shtei Nemachanot, if it's two different camps, which one does Yaakov go to? So you would say, he should go to the one with Rachel because he loves Rachel and he wants to protect Rachel. On the other hand, Yaakov has an arrow, which we call this, he has a bullseye on his back. Whichever group he's with, that group is more vulnerable. So now what do? Do you now say to Leah, listen, Leah, I'd like to spend some quality time with you and leave Rachel? I know that's terrible what I'm saying, but what do? How do you decide which group you go to? You divide into two different groups. So now what do you do? You're two different groups because you're afraid that everyone's going to be killed, and therefore maybe one will get away. So now what do I do? Where do I go? Vayakom alay luvi kachat shtei nashav et shtei shivchotav et achad aser yadav v'yavor et mavar yabok. But again, it really was already two camps, but now he takes all of them together. V'yikachem v'yirem al nachav v'yir et asher lo, and he takes them someplace else. So what's this movement going on over here? Now, by the way, my suspicion is, and maybe I'm letting my imagination get the best of me, and we'll hereby reveal my misspent youth of watching too much television or watching too many movies, that Yaakov probably at this point worries for a second, hold it. What if one of the people that I sent has been cross-examined by Esav and his 400 men and gave up and told us exactly what we're doing and told us about our two groups? So now my cover is blown and that whole plan, now I have to go into a different plan and they're going to be looking for different groups and I have to do something else. For that matter, maybe even Yaakov planted some misinformation with them. And as I know, I'm getting carried away right now. But I'm just pointing out that Yaakov had a plan. The plan was two different groups. And now he broke that plan. And he goes, takes all of them, goes someplace else. And then Pasuk Kafei is interesting because of my question. So which group should he join? Should he be with Rachel, who he loves? Should he be with Leah? Or Vayivater Yaakov Lado? I don't know if this is decision. I don't know if this is indecision. I don't know if the decision, again, I don't even know if there's two groups anymore. I do know that Yaakov is not with them, and Yaakov has decided that he is the one who they're going to be looking for. But is this an act of bravery or is this an act of cowardice? Which means that why is he not with either group and why is he by himself? What will happen when the soldiers do come? Will he get away? Again, exactly what is happening, I don't have an answer to, but what I do want to pay attention to is what happens next. And that is Vayavek Ishimo Adalota Shachar. Somebody, an anonymous assailant, attacks him until the break of day. And we know the story, so I'm not going to read all of it. Vayaraki lo yachalo vayiga bekach kafi yerecho vateka kafi yerech Yaakov bevekeimo. And Yaakov suffers an injury, and the injury is in his thigh. And from wrestling with him, he says, release me, the morning is coming, I won't release you unless you bless me. What's your name? My name is Yaakov. No, your name isn't Yaakov. And because you have struggled with man, with God, you've been victorious. The consensus, and it's really based upon a pasuk and Navi later on, is that this is indeed an angel. The consensus of which angel it is, that it is an angel of Esav, Saro Shel Esav, who has gotten a go at Yaakov. Again, we keep in mind that before Yaakov was even born, him and Esav struggle, and now the night before Yaakov struggles with this power of Esav. I do want to add another element, and maybe I'll just go back and just read the words one more time, or not. There's something about the writing over here which is very, very difficult. And my sense is the difficulty of the writing, there's a reason, there's a message in it. Let me just show you what I mean by this. It says, Vayivater Yaakov levado, he's all by himself, Vayavek Ishimo, so one missing a clause. It should have said, and somebody came, somebody attacked him. Vayarki lo yachalo, he saw he couldn't defeat him, but he got bakaf yirecho, and he was hurt in his thigh. It should have said, who it's talking about. And he, either this man, this assailant, this angel, Sarosh el Esav, saw he couldn't be victorious, or Yaakov saw he couldn't be victorious. Either way, it should have said who it is we're talking about, and he was hurt in his thigh, and it should say who, rather than have to come and qualify afterwards. I'm not going to read every element over here, which is the second time I said I'm not going to read it, but my sense is that it's written in a very dreamlike quality to it. In dreams, not all the details make sense. In dreams, there are missing pieces. You're all by yourself, and then someone else is there. And I'm not even saying that it's a dream, although there would be a reason to say that. And that reason would be is that when Yaakov left Israel all those years ago, he's all by himself and he lays down and he has a dream and he sees angels. So it would be very appropriate now that now, right before he comes back, he's all by himself and he has a dream and he sees an angel. And therefore, the parallel between those two dreams is something which I find interesting. And even if this isn't a dream, it can also be that moment before you fall asleep, where you're someplace between being awake or being asleep, and your imagination is very much alive, especially when you think somebody wants to kill you. Nonetheless, Yaakov gets hurt. And that is really what we want to deal with today. Why does he get hurt? There's an afterthought to all of this, and because he gets hurt in his thigh, therefore Jews can't eat the Gid Hanasha. And you've all heard me say many times, thank God he didn't break a rib, right? So we've just lost the Gid Hanasha. We didn't lose the ribs. I hope so. At least some of you appreciated that. At least maybe now we know what should be on the menu for Shabbat, but not Gid Hanasha. But why does Yaakov get hurt? Meaning, the next day, when he meets the real Esav, it seems to go quite okay. So again, my question is, why does he get hurt? And if it's not a good enough question, why does he get hurt, then why does he get hurt in his thigh? Why in his Bekaf Yericho, Kaf Yerech Yaakov, why? That's the whole question I want to deal with today. And therefore, I'll just take you through the stages of what I was looking for, what I was thinking about. If any of you had the misfortune to look at my sources, I really hope you didn't. I'd even post all of them right now on my document right here. I don't know if you can see the bottom. I don't know if you can see that. It says I have 27 pages of sources. So it is far beyond what we're going to do today. I mean, we need to stop before Shabbos, so we're not going to go there. But again, the thought process was very simple. First is the word Yerech. Where else is the word Yerech used? And I'll limit myself to Chamishi Chumshe Torah. That was the first thought that I had. Where else is Yerech? Where else is it used? How else is it used? And does that tell me what it means? And once I know what it means in the other context, does it therefore shed light in what happened here, or maybe what should have happened here, what didn't happen here? Is this a punishment? Is this something else? But I said, all of this is going to go around that one question, but what is the Yerech? What is the meaning of the Yerech? First, let's pause a little bit and get a little bit more context. One, when Yaakov left, as I told you before in source number two, his mother tells him to go. And I love the way that the Lavan family, I'm sorry for blaming them, speak. V'yashavti imo yomim achadim. You'll spend a couple days there. That's also like love. You'll work for another week, another, right? But we all know it's a bit more than that. But she says you'll spend some days there. Ad asher tashuv chamat achicha, till your brother's anger subsides. And we don't know right now, which is at least 20 years according to Pshat, maybe 34 years according to rabbinic calculations or chronology. So that's a long time. So a couple days, he'll calm down. And now a lot of time has gone on. We don't know if he's calmed down. Ad shuv af achichem bimcha v'shachachat asher asita lo, until he forgets it. And we don't know if that's ever going to happen. V'shalachti, and I'll send for you. V'lekachtichem misham, and I'll bring you back. And we don't know if she ever sent for him, and we don't know if she ever sees him again. We never hear from Rivka again. This is the end. Rivka gets crossed off at this point and thrown off the island, and we never hear from Rivka again. So that's interesting. And we don't know. I mean, you could make a theory. I think I spoke about that last year or 2 years ago, that maybe this Dvora Maneket Rivka, who we find dies in this week's parsha, maybe that's the one that Rivka sent. So, okay, time to come back. But if she sent him, it's time to come back. That means that she knows that Esav has calmed down. If Esav indeed calmed down, what in the world is he doing with his 400, you know, marching band, you know, 400 men? No, I mean, there's something missing over here. So maybe she never did send for him. So if she never sent for him, we can understand why Yaakov doesn't want to come back so soon. So we'll pause there. In source number three, God speaks to him, and this is the beginning of Ayetze, and God says to him, you know, I'm going to give you this land, you're going to have a lot of children. You know, those blessings will come again and again from God. And he says, but also, I'm going to make sure you come back. In Pasuk Tet Vav, I'm going to bring you back to this land. Ki lo azvacha ad asher imasiti et asher dibariti lach. He says, I will fulfill all of the promises I'm making to you. You know, I'm going to bring you back. Yaakov then makes a vow, right? He says, the name of this place is Beit El. Vayidor Yaakov Neder, he makes a vow. And he says, again, minimal requests. By the way, that may be important. And I return to my father's home. Okay, I'm gonna make a donation. So part of, you know, I have to always think also what I'm gonna talk about on Shabbat afternoon between Mincha and Maariv. I give a talk, at least this point, out in the cold, generally on halacha. So maybe I'll talk about people who make a misha be'erach and say, I'm going to give this and this present. Should I bother telling you the joke about this? We don't have time for jokes today, but it's the only thing that people remember. There was this guy who I don't remember what kibbutz he wanted. Maybe it was maftiona, and they decide to auction it off in the shul. And one guy says $50, another guy says $100, another guy says $500. Then one guy jumps up and says $5,000. Whole shul goes quiet. $5,000. Nobody. So once, twice, three, they give it to him. They give him the aliyah. They give him this. Everybody's so happy. $5,000. They're waiting for, actually, if you say more money, let's say $50,000. I just upped it. $50,000. Crazy money. And everyone is so, wow, this is unbelievable. And then like a week goes by and 2 weeks go by and a month goes by and they honored him by the dinner and then this. And the guy doesn't give the money. And then a couple more months, and somebody comes over to him from the shul, the president, the treasurer, you know, what's going on? And he sort of laughs it off. Come on, that was just kind of a joke. And they decide they're going to sue him. They take him to court. And he made a public declaration, and they try him, and the judge finds that he made an obligation. He has an obligation to pay the money. So anyway, the next year, Yom Kippur rolls around. The guy comes back to shul. And the same thing happens. Somebody says, you know, $500, $5,000, and he yells $50,000, and they all like try to ignore him. He goes, fine, $50,000 and court costs. So maybe Yaakov over here, he made a vow. So making the vow, so Yaakov, you know, there's a point to make a vow, by the way, especially in front of God. God, if you take care of me and you save me and you protect me, then I'm gonna do something. I'm gonna build a Beit Elokim. I'm gonna, you know, this matzeva will become a Beit Elokim. And one of the things I'm saying this in the level of pshat is okay. So when does Yaakov do that? But so by the way, I've actually given you two challenges to think about. One is the various formations that Yaakov has his family in. You know, does it change, and how many times does it change, and what's going on with that? And the second thing, does Yaakov keep his vow, and does he get reminded about this as we move along the way? So that's something we need to pay attention to. But we get to chapter 30, we get to source number 4. As soon as Rachel gives birth to Yosef, Yom Yaakov Lavan, Shlachein V'Rachel Makom Ilo, Artsi. As soon as Yosef is born, I want to go home. So we, and by the way, this is very good, because God doesn't say anything to him, as far as we can tell. Doesn't remind him, listen, time to go back. We don't see Rachel coming, and sorry, Rivka sending any kind of message. We hear Yaakov himself speaking. It gets a little bit more complicated when we get to source number 5, which is now the next chapter, chapter 31, Perek Lamed Aleph. Vayomer Hashem el Yaakov. This is after Yaakov has been working more to make his money back in order to leave, in order to go back so he wouldn't be empty-handed. Vayomer Hashem el Yaakov, shuv el eretz avotecha v'atecha v'ye'imach. Go back, I'll be with you. Now, by the way, that should again be enough. God said it to him all those years before, I'll be with you. Now God says again, I'll be with you. So Yaakov then calls Rachel and Leah, and they go out and they speak where nobody can hear out there in the field. And Yaakov along the way says, God protected me, and God was the one who made sure that I made all the money now. He goes on to say, God is the one who gave it to me. And this is not just this religious feeling of Yaakov. You get to Pasuk Yud Aleph, you actually get to a revelation. Which means actually he had inside information, I mean, how to win. I mean, Yaakov should have taken this malach and gone to Vegas, and he would have been set because he had some inside information over here from this malach, how exactly to go about and win. But now Yaakov is admitting this to Rachel and Leah. And again, Vata kol asher amalo kim alach asei. Rachel may say, okay, whatever God said, do. And at that point, it says he goes, and it's also very interesting, Pasuk Yudchet. He takes all the mikneh, he takes all the rechush, and he, right, Lavo el Yitzchak aviv Arza Kanan, and he heads back to his father. Again, no word about his mother. So we don't know if she's still alive. We don't know if she sent any messages. We don't know what happened. All of that is a closed book. We just don't know what to do with it. And then Lavan starts chasing after him. And what happens? then we're told Vayavo Elokim Alavan Arim B'Chalom Alayla. And then God, you know, he's pulled this before. He's done this to Avimelech, this sort of mafia tactic. Let's have a conversation, right? To Avimelech it was, let's have a conversation. You do anything wrong to Avim, you're dead. And over here, Lavan, by the way, is a big mechutzif, because he says, you better not speak to me, Tov or Adra. And then he says to Yaakov afterwards, God came to me and told me not to speak to you, Mitov Adra, which is, I think, really defeats the point a little bit. But nonetheless, God said, I'm going to take care of you. And God comes and says, I'm taking care of you. So therefore, you know, you better watch out, God says here. He shomer lecha, you better watch out. And we do see along the way, just again, to make sure we know where we are and why we're here, Yaakov has come back, and this is, you know, already source number six, right after the struggle with this angel. He looks up and he sees that there are these people. Now again, vayichatz et ha'yaladim aleha v'al Rachel v'al shtei ha'shfachot. So again, we have some kind of division, but we're not exactly sure how much this is going to save them at this point. And then we have our meeting and perhaps our reconciliation. We have in Pasuk Vav, Tishtachavena, they bow down, and again, Vishtachavu, and they bow down, and so on. Anything else we need? Yes. By the end of this chapter, Yaakov gets to Shechem, which, by the way, is one of the first place that Avram gets to. He gets to Shechem, V'yatzev Shem Mizbeach, he builds a Mizbeach, V'yikralo El Elohei Yisrael. And my only question is, has he now fulfilled his vow? Has he done what he needs to do? Or perhaps not. Afterwards, when we get to chapter 35, which we skipped 34, which is the whole episode of Dina, Vayomer Elokim al Yaakov, Kum alei Beit El. He says, go back to Beit El. So now we have to stop a second. If Yaakov really did everything he wanted to do, Vishev Shem, go there. Vasei Shem Mizbeach l'kele nirei lecha b'recham b'nei Esav achicha. And go then build that Mizbeach by that place that you went to when you ran away from your brother, which means God is not necessarily, till this point, with the position that Yaakov has done what he needs to do. I'm skipping a bit over here again. Vayovo Yaakov Luza Beretz Kanan Hu Beit El. Vayivin Shem Mizbeach Ralakom El Beit El Kisham Niglu Elav Elokim Bevrachom Bnei Echav. Then we have Dvorah dying. Vayera Elokim El Yaakov Obvo Papan Aram Vayavarachito. And then he changes his name. At this point, God changes his name. And finally, in Pasuk Yudalid, Vayetziv Yaakov Matseva b'makom asher diber ito matsevat avin v'yitzach alav nesach v'yitzach alav shemen, which is very similar to what he did the first time. V'yikra Yaakov at shem makom asher diber ito shem sham Elokim Beit El. And right after this, what happens? Rachel dies, and then he builds another matseva, which now should concern us a little bit. So, after all of that, I've gone in one direction in all of this. I don't know if you heard what I was saying. Everything I was saying was pointed to one direction, and that was, has Yaakov kept his word? Has he done what it is that he was supposed to do? Is everything okay between Yaakov and God? And I'm sorry for putting it in those terms. And now, in case you weren't clear why I did all of that, now I'll explain exactly why I did. And that has to do with the first time that the term was actually used. What term is that? Yerech. It's used by Avraham in source number 8. When Avraham asks his Eved to make a vow, Simna yodcha tachat yerechi, Vashpiacha b'Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Lo tikach isha livni b'bnot taknani, Ki elotziv malti telech. Now there's a lot over here which is connected, you know, in one way or the other with where Yaakov is and why it is and so on. Which means, first thing, the word is here. Second thing, what is the connection? The connection is making a vow. Which therefore then leads me to pose my question, which I was trying to, I won't even say dance around, but trying to point out a bit. Not enough, by the way. Did Yaakov keep his vow? Which means, is the reason that Yaakov is attacked specifically in the Yerech because he did not keep the vow he was supposed to keep? And that is based upon, as I'll say it again, the first time that word is used. But it's more than that, because the context over here is make a vow, go to the place, get a wife, and then come back. Which means, the fact that Yaakov delays and tarries and spends so much time and so on, is he to be blamed for that? Or I could say quite the opposite. Please, why are we comparing these cases? There, we sent the Eved on a mission, and over here, Yaakov is running for his life, and part of the background of the whole thing is Esav, and we can't remove Esav from this entire story. We later on have Yaakov himself saying, in source number 9, Simna yadcha tachat yirechi, and over here is, don't bury me in Egypt, but rather bring me back home. So it's interesting that the context of both of those vows is to go back home, where Avram tells the Eved, you know, you got to make sure that Yitzhak stays here. He can't go there, and make the vow that you're going to bring the girl here and not let him go there. And over here, Yaakov is saying, you have to make a vow that you're not going to bury me here. I want you to bring me back to Eretz Yisrael. So it's interesting that one of the promises that God made to Yaakov was that the land of Israel will be yours. So I'm just pointing out that this vow may somehow be connected, but I'll be more specific. Does Yaakov keep the vow in a timely fashion, or did God have to then call him up and say, listen, you know, what about the court costs? You know, what's going on over here? You may not have kept this in the way that you should. And I'll say it again, that could be a very frightening thought. Later on, the word Yerech is going to be used in source number 10, having to describe the children of Yaakov, Yerech Yaakov, the children of Yaakov, the offspring of Yaakov, which is not disconnected from the first part. Rashi tells us, why does Avram say to the Eved to put his hand tachet Yerechi? Because that is around the area of the Brit Milah, and therefore that is the place which is holy on his body, and therefore I want you to swear by something which is sacred, and therefore to connect the Yerech with children also becomes something which is interesting. The next time the Erech is used is a connection to the Mishkan. So what does that have to do with anything? Is that even the same word? Retain al-Shulchan b'olamot al-Yerech Mishkan Tzfona. Right afterwards, al-Yerech Mishkan Negba. There are other times the word Yerech will be connected to the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash. So of course, I'll say the Mishkan, I'll leave it. And you'll say, well, what does that have to do with anything? But of course, you will recognize it does have something to do with this, because what was the content of his vow? The content of his vow, I will build a Bayit L'Elokim. So therefore, perhaps this same word being used in the construction of the Mishkan is more interesting than we would have noted right away. Source number 12, again, sounds like it has nothing to do with anything. And what's that? That's something which takes place on the grounds of the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash. And it is when a woman uses poor judgment and is secluded with a man other than her husband after being warned not to, and now she's suspected of infidelity, so therefore there is this potion that she would drink, and it says quite dramatically, she will make a vow, right? We're back to a vow again, Vishbia, although you can pick on me, a neder versus a shvua, but over here it's a shvua. And it says, if things don't work out well, then what happens? It says, et yerechech nofelet. And the next verse again, ulimpil yerech, or v'nafla yerecha. It says that somehow there will be some kind of dramatic type of death. And again, we have to ask ourselves a question. Does this have anything to do? Does this shed any light whatsoever? So it's at this point that we'll pause at least a little bit. There's a book that you may not have heard of, but now you will, called Sefer HaChaim, which is written by Reb Chaim ben Bezalel. Reb Chaim ben Bezalel, as you hear the words, you see when he lives, 1520, 1588, he was a Rav, a Posek, and he's the older brother of the Maharal from Prague. So if that's not enough, he learned with a certain Yitzhak HaSfaradi, and afterwards he goes to Lublin, and he learns at the Maharshal and Rav Shalom Shachna, and he has a chavruta with someone known as the Rama. So therefore, I hope you realize that this is somebody who we should be taking seriously, not just because he's the Maharal's older brother, but because he seems to be a man of substance. And he tells us here, L'fish ein adam mekadesh etzmo k'ruyim batzugo, akein kochol shel Esav nogea tamid bekaf yericho shel Yaakov, that it's specifically in an area which, a sexual area where sin is possible, or this is where a particular sin takes place, one has to be very careful about the wildness of Esav somehow affecting the kaf yerech of Yaakov. Now you see the direction that he's going with this, ki ha yerech u remez l'kli ha-mishkal, That is the utensil which is used during the sexual act. In Yotzei Yerech Yaakov, which is why it speaks of the children who come out of the quote-unquote thigh of Yaakov. Va'af b'Yerech Yaakov rotza lingoa, and that's what Esav is trying to hurt. Ad she'a nasui shtei achayot. Why? Al shehayu nasui shtei achayot. That Yaakov is spiritually susceptible because he was married to two different women, and that is something which is wrong. That is something which goes against Torah law. Now, all of you can defend Yaakov and say, wonderful, it's against Torah law, but it's before Matan Torah. What do you want from him? The Ramban, by the way, will tell us in this week's parsha that the Avot, Yaakov, kept the mitzvot, but he said kept the mitzvot when they were helpful. And he kept the mitzvah of in the land of Israel, and that's why Rachel dies when he comes back to the land of Israel. It's not the easiest interpretation. It'd be far easier to say they didn't keep it. V'lo yecholo l'fisha af nusei shdei achiyot shelo ya bikdusha k'mo shekotav hatzioni. Tzioni is going to get a lot of play today. V'nitan l'kocho shel Esav yerech hasota. And therefore, Esav goes and touches the yerech, which is the yerech, which is what blows up on the sota, and that is specifically why. So therefore, when I raise this possibility, can this have anything to do with that? Can the sota have anything to do? So yeah, the sexual sins of Yaakov. And by the way, I do want to add something, which will be added by other authorities as we move on. Part of what's going to happen in Yaakov's life in this week's parsha, we're not moving far away. You want to move far away, we can move all the way next week to Yehuda. But in this week's parsha, we are going to find that his daughter Dina is going to be the victim of a sexual outrage, and we're going to find that his son Reuven, he commits a sexual outrage. All of you, I don't know if you're still stuck on the Dudaim from last time, but we have two of his sins, of his children, doing or committing sins that are somehow connected to sexuality. And over here, one has to ask, is somehow these things related to one another? And by the way, we have another frightening thought. Is Rachel's death somehow connected to all of this? Now, the problem with what I'm saying, and I hope this disturbs you, and it does disturb me, are we really going to go and blame the victims over here? Are we going to be blaming Dina? Are we going to blame Rachel for dying? Or are we going to blame Yaakov for Rachel's death? Which means this path is not an easy path, but nonetheless, there have been those who were not afraid to take this path because of this issue of the Yerech of Yaakov now connecting with this Yerech of Sota. As I said, it's not the only thing that we can say. There are others as well. And specifically, look at Source 14. Source 14 is in Parshat Shoftim. And this, by the way, is going to be the hardest thing for me to argue. When it speaks about going to war, getting ready to war, it says, don't be afraid. Al yerach levavchem. So now, is the word yerach levavchem connected somehow? You should not soften your heart. Is that connected to Yerech, the thigh? Could we possibly say such a thing? So the answer actually is, surprisingly, yes. But you have to give me a couple seconds till I get there. In Source 15 is a midrash, which maybe will take us back to the sota, but it's not specifically sota. It is Midrash and Midrash Rabbah, and it starts off, who was this adversary? Sarosh al Esav. Okay, this is the power of Esav. And then it asks, Rav Berchia asks, Ein anu yodim mi natzach? We don't know who won. Im Malach, Im Yaakov. Did Yaakov win or did the Malach win? And it tries to understand that. It tries to question that point a bit. But towards the end of this piece, it says some things which should disturb us. It says, Kach she'im yavo umot olam lehizdaveg l'Israel, if they want to join, it's zivug. Yomar l'makadosh baruch hu, sarchem lo yachol la'amod bo, your angel, your power, Sarosh l'Esav, couldn't even, hang with Yaakov, v'atem b'vakshim lezveg l'vanav, and you think you have an ability of marrying into the families? By the way, that's also very interesting in terms of the Dina episode, because over here we have immediately after that, we have Shechem trying to marry into the Yaakov family. That Yaakov's thigh getting hurt is a metaphor for his children, and there will be children of Yaakov's during the times of persecutions who will end up being hurt, and that will be because Yaakov was hurt. But now we have to say, hold it. That means that there was a punishment over here. There's repercussions, and this didn't answer for us. What are those repercussions for? So again, we need to be at least a little bit careful. The Chizkuni, I think, hints at what I wanted to say in terms of the fear connected to perhaps the Yerech being hurt. Kaf Yerech Yaakov, 16. By the way, notice, Teilech, walking. When you hurt your thigh, you can't walk well. I assured you that I will protect you wherever you walk. He was punished because he was afraid. And we see also by Moshe that he was punished there. And by the way, that scene in the quote-unquote hotel in the Malone actually very much reminded me of this scene. I wrote this in a footnote someplace, that the two scenes remind me of one another. And I had not seen this Chizkuni at the time, saying that he thinks that the theme of the two are connected. But when he makes reference to it in Shemot, where God tells Moshe, I'm going to harden Paro's heart, there he does bring the pasuk v'lo yirach levavo. So it's very interesting that he does bring it over there, but I don't want to work so hard. Look at source number 18. Source number 18 is a pasuk in Iov. Yechpots znavo kmo arez, gide pachadav yisragu. So I thought that the Hebrew was easy, so I brought the English for you. He made his tail stand up like a cedar, the sinews of his thighs are knit together. And the word over here for Yerech, it used a different word. It used the word pachad. And that's really interesting, because where do they get that the word Yerech can also mean pachad? So apparently we have a biblical source. Again, I'm not willing to say this 100%, but I think 99% that you have a biblical source. Again, this is with the Gid Hanasheh, the Gid of the Pachadav. This is the same area. So it really seems to lead us in that direction, that Yerach Levav may really be connected to the Gid Hanasheh, to the Yerech of Yaakov, and therefore you can strengthen this argument that maybe the reason that Yaakov is hurt is because he was afraid, and God said not to be afraid, and he should have more faith. So essentially, I've just taken you in a bunch of different directions, and I'm not even willing to tell you that I'm willing to say I don't like one of them, because I like all of them. And the directions that we've taken so far are a direction of saying that maybe Yaakov doesn't keep his vow, maybe Yaakov is afraid, maybe there is now this punishment specifically with the Yerech, and that it's going to affect his children. Maybe it's because of his own sexual sins in terms of marrying two sisters, and that's something which isn't appropriate, although that's the hardest one to make. But nonetheless, this connection with Sota, as I said, some have made it. In source number 20, we have the Chumat Anach, which is the Chida. He goes into this issue of Yaakov marrying two sisters, and he actually makes a fascinating argument. We're not going to read it. You have it. You can look at it if you choose. His argument is that when David HaMelech is going to be attacked for his lineage, that he comes from all kinds of problematic relationships, and therefore maybe David HaMelech is illegitimate in a very literal sense. So part of the counter argument is, but what are you talking about? The whole Jewish people comes from Yaakov, who was married to two sisters, and therefore we come from the same kind of compromised background. And, you know, what right do we really have to argue any stronger? Just look at what he does. Vaharav Hagirshuni, in the middle where it's bolded, and Vayishlach, says, "I'm a David Yisrael. Ad matay etem chotim va'omrim pasul mishpachahu? How long are you going to say that, you know, he's illegitimate? Af atem boi mi asur shtei achayot v'amru chazal shemalach naga bekach kaf yirecho zegir nosh mishum shenasa shtei achayot." So again, this argument of connecting it with the sexual sins and arguably with the sota is brought into this commentary as well. Along the way, he goes in, and again, and this is what helps create David HaMelech, and we will leave it at that. He does say along the way that v'agam kisar esav nagav kaf chirchiyam mikom Yaakov lo chata b'shtei achayot mikam etzei ritzim amitiim. He goes, there are a number of ways to explain this, and he doesn't go, but he doesn't necessarily tell us what they are. Okay, but he does do one other thing along the way, and that is towards the end over here of the first part, he says that part of the secret over here is this sod, hanachash hashieni. Part of this is the secret of the nachash. So I just want to look at the pasuk that he's referring to. I'm sorry if you're not realizing why we're here. We're here because he just told us to go there. But very quickly we'll realize there's another reason. V'yomer shema elokim le'isha, mazot asit. V'tom yisha, hanachash hashieni v'ochel. The nachash, the English here, is beguiled me. By the way, this is also Rama'ut. He fooled me. And if I would have translated this as Rama'ut, it would fit much more in the Yaakov Lavan story along the way, where there was a lot of Rama'ut. But it's the nachash fooled me. V'yom Hashem elokim el nachash, ki asita zot arur ata mikol ha-behima, mikol chayat ha-sadeh, and spells out its entire punishment. And the very end, v'ata tishupenu akev, you will bruise his heel. Now, just in case you're still wondering why we're here. So there's two things about this. One is this beguiling behavior of the serpent, and you don't know yet why that may or may not be connected, or maybe you don't remember. And the other thing is that the Akev is over here, and Akev is, of course, the first time that we find some kind of form of Yaakov's name appearing, but it's appearing as this battle that will take, a bruising will take place between the serpent, and there's going to be this war going on between the serpent and he will bruise your head and you will bruise his heel, that there is a fight taking place between this nachash and between man, but this man's heel is going to get hurt. And again, if you're still wondering why we're here, so over here we're talking about an epic battle. Now, maybe we don't know this and maybe we should know this. The Sarah Shel Esav, you know, one of the books I have on the shelf over there, I know exactly where it is my encyclopedia of angels and demons, written by Rav Reuven Margoliot. Everyone should have one. Sometimes you need to know if it's an angel or a demon. So the Sar of Esav has a name, which some people don't even want to say, because they say it can bring bad things into your house. And the name is called Samael, which is also known as the Satan, which is also known as the Malach HaMavet, which is also known as the Nachash, which means all of these things are associated with one another. This is the Sarah Shel Esav. The Sarah Shel Esav is this Satan. It is this thing which we are fighting against. So therefore you have the Satan who tries to get Eve to sin and succeeds, by the way. And then there's going to be this battle taking place between the Nachash and between man, and man is going to step on it with his heel, and now you have the battle between Yaakov and the Sarah Shel Esav. So I'm just pointing out, again, we've just now gone someplace between Midrash to Kabbalah, but I'm still going back to that verse. I'm just pointing out that what was said back to the Nachash in the Garden of Eden is not that different from what we read in this mysterious episode that takes place between Yaakov and this Malach who's called the Sarah Shel Esav, and it's actually far more similar than perhaps we even imagine. When we come to Yaakov's being born, v'yacharechen yatza achiv yada ochezet ba'akev Esav. And Yaakov is called Yaakov because Yaakov is grabbing onto the heel of Esav. So it's very interesting that he gets the name Yaakov. Maybe they should call it Esav. It was his heel. But Yaakov grabs onto Esav's heel. So by the way, it's already interesting then. Yaakov grabs onto Esav's heel. Esav's sar grabs onto Yaakov's thigh. Each of them are grabbing at one another's leg. That's part of this eternal battle which is taking place. And that's what we spent a lot of time with previously. The Targum here says, now that's actually going to create a big, big discussion what that means. Nachash yidkon. There's an different girsaot. Some have a resh, some have a dalid. And that's what it says about him. What exactly does that mean? So we'll. Here's a nice book. It's called Netinat Lager. Netinat Lager is written by Rav Natan Adler, not the first Rav Natan Adler, but Rav Natan Adler, who was the chief rabbi of England, not the Natan Adler who was the rabbi of the Chatam Sofer. Rather, the second one, the chief rabbi of England, who is my grandson Kedem's great 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 grandfather. So that's also why we mention him over here. Ish Tzayid Gvar, and whatever that word meant. So first he says, look in Baba Batra, look at Tosfot over there. We'll see what he says. He says, "Shakad fushahu adam batel," that he's a lazy kind of fellow who goes out hunting, who sits around and he waits for the hunt to come to him. But he's not a hard worker. It's not like a farmer. It's not like somebody actually takes, or a dentist. It's not somebody who actually takes responsibility. It's somebody who sits around. And that is based upon, I think, a Persian interpretation of that word, or source of that word. Shushim Torah Bukav Min Nach, Noach, takes it easy. Umin Srach, Ratzlama Ish Batel Minucha Vohev Batala. I don't know what you would call such a person. Ba'in Baran Ban, and others who also tell us what it means. Nachash. Shahayalo Nachash Al Yericho Lissiman. And there are those who claim that he had this, I mentioned, a tattoo of a serpent on his thigh. Okay? So that's what I still left over from last time. It's a little clearer to read Rav Kasher in the Torah Shleim over here. He also goes through the same kind of sources, tells you what to look at. Really, the source that we need to see is the Tziuni al Torah. I believe he's the first one who puts it down in writing. That on Esav's, and then he says Va'onkelos, and he quotes that Onkelos that we just now saw. So he tells us that, again, this may seem completely, you know, unconnected, but it's telling us that Esav on his thigh had a nachash, and Yaakov wrestles with this saroshel Esav, who's associated with the nachash, who grabs at his thigh, and he hurts his thigh. So again, there is something happening over here. And again, if I would turn this into more of our things we're familiar with, which is like cartoons, where you have forces of good and forces of evil, and there's good and bad, and the world is really divided in this way, but that's very much what is taking place over here, which means when we try now to understand what exactly is taking place, and why is the thigh being affected, and one of the things that we saw in an early source, the Midrash Rabbah, is this is going to affect Yaakov's children. So, in the time that we have left, I want to tell you what some of the other sources are going to tell us. One whole approach is going to attack Yaakov and his thigh for bowing down to Esav. That Yaakov will, right after this, and we saw this already, him and all his children are going to bow down, and that is going to be seen as a very big problem, and that is going to hurt his children, and that's going to hurt them during the Shat HaShmad. And specifically, the most specific Shat HaShmad that this is going to lead us to is going to be during the time of Purim. And that also will need to be explained. There is a tradition that Mordechai had bought Haman for food, which means what that midrash, and it's really a targum as well, connected to Megillat Esther, is telling us, is that the Yaakov-Esav dynamic, whereby Yaakov and Esav had a barter of something and food was involved in it, that happened also between Haman and Mordechai, where Mordechai owned Haman, and essentially his argument was, excuse me, you're from Amalek, and the Jews own you, and we are the firstborn, and you will continually fall, and that's part of what Esav's argument is. On the other hand, we're going to find sources that are going to tell us that Yaakov caused Esav pain, and he screamed in pain, and that's why the Jews are going to end up screaming in pain during the Purim story, which means, again, it goes back more to this punishment side of it. Mordechai does not bow down, which therefore is seen as therefore fixing the thigh, as it were, because all of the children do bow down. So this whole theme taking place that Yaakov hurts his thigh, and what is the message behind it? As I said, a lot of the sources are going to end up taking us very much to the story of Purim, but let me then mention something else, which also we should pay attention to. You know, there is this famous teaching from the Tikkuni Zohar that Purim and Yom Kippur have some kind of connection to it. Without saying any further what that connection may be, on Yom Kippur, or Yom Kippurim, we're told that on that day the Satan has no power. The Satan in Gematria comes out to 364, and there's one day a year, 365, that the Satan has no power. The Jews can just turn to God. Now, part of the secret of that power is, or the lack of power, or how we have power over, is that Yaakov defeats the Satan. I mean, that's part of it. The other part of it is, and this is based on the Pirkei de Rabbelezer, and the Ramban cites this, is that we give a bribe to Esav. Yaakov gives a bribe to Esav, which is understood as the Seir Lazazel. Those of us missing a piece over here, let's go back and think a second. The two Seirim are supposed to look identical, like twins. One is LaHashem, and one is Azazel. Which means on Yom Kippur, we have a dynamic where these two different Seirim go in two different directions. Over here, we have this dynamic where Yaakov and Esav will go in two different directions. Esav would actually go to Seir Lazazel. He will go to Seir, and Yaakov is going to go to Sukkot. The Zohar tells us that the battle between Yaakov and Esav took place on Yom Kippur. Which means that night of the battle, the night before, is the night of Kol Nidre. It's Yom Kippur. Which means the whole feeling, as far as the Zohar is concerned, is that this is Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, the Satan can't touch us. On Yom Kippur, we can't be touched. On the other hand, Yom Kippur and Purim have this similarity to it, but Haman, Amalek, and so on, they are coming after us on Purim. So yeah, Purim and Yom Kippur have a similarity to it, but one is they can't touch us because Yaakov defeats Esav. I want to explain this maybe a little bit deeper, again, based on some Kabbalistic things that I saw. Yaakov's vision, and I told you in the beginning, I very much want to connect his vision that he had when he leaves Israel, and he sees this ladder going up to heaven, his feet on the ground, head up in heaven, and angels going up and angels coming down. It's interesting that an angel has now come down, and Yaakov now is battling with that angel. Which means, and moreover, there's a beautiful midrash, I believe it's mentioned in the Gemara as well, that Yaakov's face is on the Kisei HaKavod up there in heaven. So again, let's work a little bit harder. I mean, Purim is this time after the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. Part of not having a Beit HaMikdash goes back to Yaakov not building it on time. You may not want to blame him for that, and maybe that's maybe that part makes you uncomfortable. Maybe the part with Dina, maybe the part with Rachel. I'm saying there's a lot of elements over here, a lot of moving parts. Not keeping a vow. I mean, maybe that was the easiest one. This comparison with Sota, and as I said, I'm not necessarily willing to discard any of them. I mean, what I did is I looked for all the places that it's used. The fear, right? Yirach levavav, the fear involved as well. Pachad, and pachad is a word that Yaakov uses many times. But again, when we start looking at the various, you know, meanings of this, so is Yaakov somehow responsible for the Beit HaMikdash not being built soon enough? The whole story of Purim takes place, by the way, in a delay of building of the Beit HaMikdash, and that's what the Jews are doing out there, and that's why there is a Purim, instead of the Jews being inside Eretz Yisrael and having a Yom Kippur, where the Kohen Gadol is going to bring about Kapara for the entire people. Which means, yes, Yaakov's battle with Esav takes place on Yom Kippur, and something there happens, but Yaakov gets hurt. So the hurt means there's some kind of susceptibility. So what is that susceptibility? So as I said, one way of going further with this is going to be what happens with Dina right afterwards. Maybe the Reuven story, maybe the Yehuda story, right? Maybe the death of Rachel. And all of these are very, very difficult things for us to accept. But when somebody is Yaakov Avinu, did he delay in keeping his word? Did he delay in keeping the vow? And the vow was the easiest and the first interpretation that we had in terms of Yerech. Make the vow. There's even one beautiful interpretation, I believe was the Shlach HaKadosh, who says as follows. He says, why does the angel attack Yaakov's thigh? Because when Yaakov bought the Bechorah from Esav, he said to him, promise. He said, I promise. He said, Simna Yodcha Tachet Irechi. Put your hand by my Yerech and make a vow that you are going to give me the Bechorah. And therefore, what the angel's trying to do to attack Yaakov, he's trying to take that Bechorah back, and he's trying to show that Yaakov doesn't keep his word, and Esav doesn't have to keep his word, and that is this whole being hit by the Yerech, and then Yaakov is actually victorious over him, but Yaakov is going to have to keep his word. So as I said, I can take the various elements of them, and now you realize why I had 27 pages of sources, because there are just so many ways of weaving this together, but all I was trying to point out over here is that, again, simple question, why is Yaakov hurt? Second follow-up question, why the thigh? Why the Yerech? What's the meaning of it? So I came to various answers. And as I said, I'm not going to accept one and throw away the others. I'm leaving them all to dance around in your heads and figure out which one of these makes the most sense to you. But is it a vow which wasn't kept? Is it a vow with Esav now? He realized a whole other side of this. Does this represent the vow that he made with Esav? Is it somehow connected to this Nachash, which is on Esav's leg, this force of evil on Esav Nachash, which is really fascinating because Esav has a Nachash on his Yerech, and Yaakov becomes a mitzvah of Gid HaNasha, where therefore we're going to reject this Gid, we're not going to eat this Gid, and therefore we're going to turn this into an act of Kedusha. Is the real victory against Esav is that we're going to leave him on the side with all of his sorcery and all of his magic and all of his power, which by the way was mentioned by some, and instead we're going to create a world of Kedusha, that therefore this battle with Esav is not a simple battle, and it is the same battle that will take place later with Haman, but eventually, I'll say it the other way around, we are going to be victorious. The idea of this being Yom HaKippurim, where the Satan is given his bribe and given his gift, and then go Lech L'Azazel, now go, get away, we've had enough of you, leave, and that ends up protecting us. So that's also a very interesting dynamic over here. But as I said, there are a lot of commentaries who do not like the idea that we bow down to Esav, we gave them power, we gave Esav power, and that is going to be a whole part of the Purim story as well, when we all bow down to Esav, which means what really is the takeaway over here, that we're able to defeat the Sarushal Esav, or that we bow down to Esav himself, which means that's really the tension over here, that we defeat the Sarushal Esav, and that's what creates a Yom Kippur for us, that we can then just, even the Sarushal Esav, Satan is going to have to testify that the Jews are okay, or the fact that we bow down to Esav himself, is that going to give the power of a Haman to demand for all of us to bow down to him, until one person doesn't bow down, and that person, of course, is from the one son who doesn't bow down, because he's an Ishimini, he's from Binyamin, and they're from Mordechai doesn't bow down. But again, this beautiful Targum says, but not only that, he has tied to his thigh the contract whereby he bought him, which actually goes back to the Bechora, which means we can't move away from this Bechora. And as I'll say it again, there are just so many moving pieces over here. I hope that I didn't confuse you completely. I hope you're walking away with some type of clarity of some kind of something. Of course, the danger of this today is that every one of you are going to walk away with your own conclusion and swear that I said something that, of course, I didn't say. But that's the price that I have to pay. Anyway, you are able to unmute yourselves if you so like.